The Theosophical Society presents Mr. Capel McCutcheon in a talk entitled The Occult Nature of Love.
Well, any of you in the audience today that are as old as I am can probably look back over the years and will recall the lyrics to a song that was popular then. It went something like this. What is this thing called love? This crazy thing called love? And the gentleman goes on and asks the stars in heaven above, what is this thing called love? And it seems to me that many of us joyfully uplifted in a moment of ecstasy or feeling terribly dejected and alone, very much alone, or in ways profound or superficial, have echoed this query, what is this thing called love? Today, I'd like to inquire with you into its nature to see if we can use this tremendous force within the universe to increase our own understanding and our own happiness. Well, in the dawn of this Aquarian age, it behooves us all to be good empirical scientists and to examine the evidence. Or perhaps I should say examine the testimony, since there's a difference between that and evidence. And to do so, let's consult the experts, the poets, the philosophers, the religious mystics, the lovers of all the ages, and see what they had to say about this subject. Mr. Shakespeare adds his comments when he says, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out e'en to the end of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved." Maurice Chevalier adds a somewhat cynical note when he suggests that many a man has fallen in love with a girl in light so dim he would not have chosen a suit by it. From my own hometown of Hartford, Katharine Hepburn suggests that only the really plain people know about love. The very fascinating ones try so hard to create an impression that they soon exhaust their talents. One of the great modern poets by the name of Benton has suggested, "Because hate is legislated, written into the primer and testament, shot into our blood and brain like vaccine and vitamins. Because our love is of time, of hours, and the clock hand turns, closes the circle upon us, and black timeless night sucks us in like quicksand, receives us totally, without a rain check or a parachute, a key to heaven, or even a long last look. Because of this, I need love more than ever now. I need your love. I need love more than hope or money, wisdom or a drink, because a slow negative death withers the world and only yes can turn the tide. Because love has your face and body, and your hands are tender, and your mouth is sweet, and God has made no other eyes like yours." That great modern philosopher of the comic strip, Snoopy, says, "I love humanity. It's just people I can't stand." Stendhal, "Love is a well from which we can drink only as much as we have put in, and the stars that shine from it are only our eyes looking in. All that we love deeply becomes a part of us. Love is caring for one another. Love is the hardest lesson, but for that reason, it should be most our care to learn it. If love should count you worthy, and should dine one day to seek your door and be your guest, pause ere you draw the bolt and bid him rest, if in your old content you would remain, for not alone he enters. In his train are angels of the mist, the lonely guest, dreams of the unfulfilled and unpossessed, and sorrow, and love's immemorial pain. He wakes in you desires you never may forget. He shows you stars you never saw before. He makes you share with him forevermore the burden of the world's divine regret. How wise were you to open not, and yet how poor if you should turn him from your door. Fritz Kunkel, a great psychologist, suggests that in marriage, to love means to decide independently to live with an equal partner and to subordinate oneself to the formation of a new subject, a we. And that very beautiful, almost of our own generation, Khalil Gibran, "Then said Al Mitra, speak to us of love." And with a great voice he said, "When love beckons to you, follow him, though his ways are hard and steep. And when his wings enfold you, yield to him, though the sword hidden in his pinions may wound you. And when he speaks to you, believe in him, though his voice may shatter your dreams, and the north wind lay waste your garden. For even as love crowns you, so shall he crucify you. Even as he is for your growth, so is he for your pruning. Even as he ascends to your height and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall he descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. Like sheaves of corn, he gathers you unto himself. He threshes you to make you naked. He sifts you to free you from your husks. He grinds you to whiteness and kneads you until you are pliant, and then assigns you to his sacred fire that you may become sacred bread for God's sacred feast. All these things shall love do unto you, that you may know the secrets of your heart, and in that knowledge become fragments of life's heart. But if in your fear you would seek only love's peace and love's pleasure, then it is better for you to cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all of your laughter, and weep, but not all of your tears. Love gives not, but itself, and takes not from itself. Love possesses not, nor would it be possessed, for love is sufficient to love. When you love, you should not say, 'God is in my heart,' but rather, 'I am in the heart of God.' And think not you can direct the course of love, for love, if it finds you worthy, directs your course. Love has no desire but to fulfill itself. But if in love you must needs have desire, let these be your desires: to melt and be like a running brook that sings its melody to the night, to know the pain of too much tenderness, to be wounded by your own understanding of love and bleed willingly and joyfully." St. Paul has suggested that if I speak with the eloquence of man and angels but have no love, I become no more than blaring brass or crashing cymbal. If I have the gift of foretelling the future and hold in my mind not only all human knowledge, but the very secrets of God, and if I also have that absolute faith that can move mountains but have no love, I amount to nothing at all. If I dispose of all I possess, yes, even if I give my own body to be burned, but have not love, I achieve precisely nothing. The love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. It looks for a way of being constructive. It is not possessive. It is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. Love has good manners and does not pursue selfish advantage. It's not touchy. It does not keep account of evil or gloat over the wickedness in other people. On the contrary, it is glad with all men when truth prevails. Love knows no limit to its endurance, no end to its trust, no fading of its hope. It can outlast anything. It is, in fact, the one thing that stands when all else has fallen. For if there are prophecies, they will be fulfilled and done away with. If there are tongues, the need for them will disappear. If there is knowledge, it will be swallowed up in truth, for our knowledge is always incomplete, and our prophecy is always incomplete. And when the complete comes, that is the end of the incomplete. When I was a child, I talked and felt and thought like a little child. And now that I am a man, my childish speech and feeling and thought have no further significance to me. At present, we are men looking at puzzling reflections in a mirror. The time will come when we shall see reality whole and face to face. At present, all I know is a little fraction of the truth, but the time will come when I shall know it as fully as God now knows me. In this life, we have three great lasting qualities: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of them is love. Our late president, Sri Ram, suggested that love may be regarded as the first pure relationship, a state of unity in duality. To be one with another is to love him, and to love him is to act from within him and through him, and not upon him from without with contrary effect. To love a friend intensely, yet with pure detachment, to let him be equally or even more a friend to others, to expect no affection while being duly appreciative of whatever affection is given, to think of how one can help rather of what gratification one can get, to be constant in friendship and unselfish helpfulness, to bring to the physical level the beautiful, selfless spirit of the higher planes, this is ideal love. Without love, there is no unfoldment, because love belongs to the life of the spirit, to the real self. Without love, all search is in vain. In our Western world, one of our great teachers said again and again the same idea from John: if anyone says, "I love God and hate his brother," he's a liar. For whoever does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. This is the commandment we get from him, that whoever loves God must love his brother also. And again, then an expert in the law got up to test him and said, "Master, what must I do to make sure of eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "What does the law say? How does it read?" And he answered, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, your whole soul, your whole strength, and your whole mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said, "You're right. Do that and you will live." On that late night, he said, "I have loved you just as the Father has loved me. You must go on living in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will live in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and live in his love. I have told you this so that you can share my joy and that your happiness may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I loved you." That modern spokesman, perhaps for some of the Aquarians, Mr. Krishnamurti, says you really love only when you do not possess, when you are not envious or greedy, when you are respectful, when you have mercy and compassion, when you have consideration. Love cannot be thought about, Love cannot be cultivated. Love cannot be practiced. The practice of love, the practice of brotherhood, is still within the field of the mind. Therefore, it is not love. When all this is stopped, then love comes into being. Then you will know what it is to love. Then love is not quantitative, but qualitative. You do not say, I love the whole world. But when you know how to love one, you know how to love the whole world. Because we do not know how to love one, our love of humanity is fictitious. When you love, there is neither one nor many. There is only love. It is only when there is love that all our problems can be solved. And then we shall know its bliss and its happiness. And now I'd like to recall our minds to the task of exploring together the nature of love. And I think one fact must stand out clearly as we've listened to these many, many people and their ideas of love, that they obviously mean different things by this, and so do we seem to mean different things by love in our world today. One seems to be describing a deep friendship, another physical sexual pleasure, another a joy in living, another a craving for a favorite possession, another ambition for fame and fortune, perhaps another a serious all-moving devotion, or another religious ecstasy, the love of God. And we can think of many other kinds of love, like the love of a father or a mother for its child and so forth. And this profusion of the ideas of love is not at all new. 2,500 years ago, Plato remarked this diversity and in his symposium tried to have Socrates clear away some of the misconceptions. And Socrates asks whether love is love of something or of nothing, and he clarifies this by an analogy. He says a father is a father of something, a mother is a mother of something, either a son or a daughter. Thus is love a love of something or love of nothing? And of course, you can't argue with it when it's written, so he says, of course love is of something. Now, Socrates says that there is also the confusing of the thing that's loved, the beloved, with love. And from this confusion of the beloved with love arises the misconception that love is beautiful or good. But it is really the object of love which are these things, he says. And because love is love of something, love is the desire for something. Therefore, love is desire. And we distinguish or name love differently depending on the object love. For instance, love of fame or power might be called ambition. Desire for another person is sometimes called love. Thus we see that love may seem to be many, many things merely because of the variety of the things that are loved. But the nature of love is simple. It's desire. But then he says, wait a minute. It isn't quite that simple. Love is not just desire. Rather, love, regardless of the objects men desire, what they really always desire is their own good. Why? Because the person who possesses good gains happiness. And happiness is considered a final human goal. Therefore, love is the desire for one's own good. But one does not love, that is, desire, what one already has or possesses, except in the sense of desiring to possess it forever. Therefore, says Plato, love is the desire of the everlasting possession of the good. But what's the nature of this act of loving, the practice of love? It's a practice subtle as well as sublime, and if we could review just a minute the reasoning up to this point, we'll see how Plato attacks this thing. Love doesn't possess what it desires, for one doesn't desire what one already possesses, except desiring to possess it always. Therefore, love can't be beautiful or good, for if it were, it wouldn't desire the beautiful or the good. Rather, since it is not beautiful or good, love must be of the beautiful or the good. In the same sense, love isn't wise. If you're wise already, you don't desire wisdom. But if you aren't wise yet, you may desire to have it and thus love wisdom. And the everlasting, therefore, when a man does love beauty, wisdom, or good, that is the everlasting possession of these things, he achieves happiness, and happiness is the final goal. But we have to stop and say, what in the world is happiness if this is the end of love? Now, Plato says that love helps in the attainment of happiness. Love can begin its help to you in such a modest way as just the love of the beauty in one particular concrete object, such as a face that you love, or an object or a possession that you love. And if this love is true love of beauty, it will shortly lead one to a similar love in other objects. Then love of beauty can lead one to recognize that this beauty in each one of the many concrete objects that one loves is the same thing, sort of an idea of beauty. And so love of beauty has led one to the beauty of the mind, a higher order of beauty, for it can exist even when physical form is not beautiful. Next, true love or beauty leads one to an understanding of the beauty of laws and ideas and actions, until at last one arrives at the true realization that there is only one beauty, which embraces all of these other beauties, sort of the absolute beauty. And it is only in this intuitive realization that one experiences truly what is the essence of beauty. Now, Plato makes the point clear that this is a transcendent realization, or an experience, as we call it today. Since this real beauty is also divine beauty, it can only be realized by communion with the divine, the experience of reality, we'd say today. For that divine beauty, which one has gotten hold of, is not an illusion, but a reality, and a reality is not mortal or temporary. Now, Plato says that in this communion with reality, one is enabled to bring forth realities, to create things, to create real things. Thus, real happiness is defined as the realization of God, or the communion of the soul with reality. And in this is the experience of absolute or divine beauty, wisdom, and good, with the consequent ability to create these real things and to thus realize immortality. And love is revealed as being the best helper of man in finding this human end, happiness. Plato says that all men always desire their own good and hence desire happiness, that transcendental happiness where real immortality is obtained. And therefore all men love, and the real love they love is the love of the everlasting possession of that good, which alone brings happiness and immortality. And therefore all men are really lovers. But different men in their search seek immortality only as they are given to understand it. Those who are basically body or physically oriented may seek it only by the procreation of children. Those of an emotional nature or a competitive spirit may seek fame and their children or deeds or acts or laws, while those of an intellectual nature eventually come to seek it by wisdom and the creation of philosophies, and eventually, if they seek truly, can arrive at that intuitive leap, that communion with reality that brings true happiness. Thus, Plato later infers that all action by all men is always a seeking of their own good, and thus motivated by love, because of love of the good. And in his explanation of the practice of love of beauty as a means to bring the soul to communion with reality, to bring man to happiness, he implies that love of wisdom is higher or more useful than love of creation, which in turn are higher than love of deeds and love of objects. Thus, and very importantly, all objects of love are good. Everything is good for Plato. But there are more useful or more elevated objects than others. And here we begin the diversion that leads us to the difficulty of today. Aristotle, while basically agreeing with his teacher, introduces a further distinction by separating love into two kinds, which are distinguished by the objects of, whether the objects of love were physical objects or satisfying emotions, or whether they were love of wisdom. He distinguishes that love of objects doesn't bring real happiness, but only temporary or impermanent happiness, and that only love of wisdom brings permanent happiness. Hence, the love of wisdom, to him, becomes the only real love. Also, the idea of a transcendent union as being real wisdom begins to disappear, and wisdom begins to take on a connotation of intellection rather than intuition. By the time we reach the scholasticism of the Middle Ages, we find that Thomas Aquinas and Dante have taken this distinction of love even further. Love of objects and love of wisdom are further distinguished by the zeal of the lover now. Aquinas would say that no love of objects can ever lead to happiness, but that excessive love of objects can lead to sinful pleasure. And in a like manner, inadequate zeal in love of wisdom will never lead to real happiness, that not the intuitive leap, but just wisdom. But only zeal in love of wisdom will do so. And finally, this introduction of the idea that love can now be bad because of the degree of its zeal in action or seeking of certain specific types of objects brings Dante to the distinction that requires explaining what is love when there is excessive love of oneself. So he introduces the concept of hate, the contrary to love. Now, love is desire, hate must be aversion. And it also can be distinguished by its objects, for as Plato might remind us, hate is hate of something, surely. Dante agrees with Aquinas that all men seek their good, but he defined man's good as that self-love which makes him seek the good. But this good, self-love, becomes only apparent good and then finally bad. When such seeking becomes excessive, when self-love becomes excessive, when a person becomes selfish, in other words. For self-love in excess excludes God. And a man cannot exist apart from the first being, they say. And in doing so, hate that first being, which is his own good. And this is what men unknowingly hate when they hate the good of another. So we find that we've split love clean in two from the days of the classicists, and we might represent it, here's good and there's evil. Here's knowledge and here's opinion. Here's zeal in the thought of God or wisdom, and here's excessive thought or desire for objects or of oneself. Here's love, but there's hate. Thus, man has been given the right to seek and achieve evil as well as good all of a sudden. All men do not choose to seek good, he says. Therefore, love can be love of the bad and the evil. Love is revealed by its actions, is no longer all good and distinguished just as a matter of degree and the success with which we're able to express our knowing how well we're able to love. Instead of that, we have suddenly become evil as well as good. Plato might have defined pride as a distorted love of ambition, a sort of distorted love of fame, and hence still one. But the scholasticists put it clear in two. Finally, Dante would agree with Plato that love assists in obtaining the human end, happiness, but he required that mind be the ruler of love, because mind had to distinguish all these distinctions that he created. Now, it's only fair to Plato to add that in this evolution of the idea of love that we've seen, his successors, and notably Dante, have fallen prey to the thing he warned us about in the first place, of confusing the beloved with the love. And it results in this profusion. And in this way, we can see that there has gradually evolved the idea of love being good or bad, depending upon the object we love, and also the degree to which we are capable of loving it. And this trend of confusing love and the object loved and its appropriateness with the appropriateness of a judgment of someone about the object loved has continued to the present day. And it, in my judgment, is at the root of the confusion that exists today about the nature and art of loving. Many people today think that to love is simple, but to find the right or fitting object to love or to be loved by, this is the difficulty. This thesis, that love is a problem of the object to be loved, and not a problem of the ability of oneself to be loving, has been eloquently pointed out by a modern psychologist by the name of Erich Fromm. He points out that there are two premises which contribute to this problem. First, that most people view the problem of love as one of being loved, which we just said, rather than loving or one's capacity to love. And secondly, the democratic ideas of romantic love, the confused notion that the initial violent emotional response to those rare occasions of intimacy that we sometimes come across, what we call falling in love, is the same thing as being in love. These premises of the nature of love prevent the majority of people from discovering its real nature. And I think a recollection of most of the popular songs of our time really contribute to our confusion as we grow up as children by making us believe that this is really what it is. Fromm says that man is a being gifted with reason, that he is life being aware of itself. Now, to be aware of anything, of course, requires that it be discreet, that we be able to distinguish that object from other things, in short, that it be separate. Each of us that is aware of self is thus aware of a sensation of separateness. Aware also are we of the shortness of physical life, the immensity of the universe, and the relative powerlessness of one man before the forces of nature or even society. Dr. Fromm suggests that it is this awareness or experience of separateness that arouses all of the anxieties in man, that it is the source of anxiety. He suggests that man's deepest need in life, therefore, is to overcome that feeling of separateness. The most fundamental and constant question that has confronted man throughout history is the question of how to overcome or eliminate separateness, or stated positively, how to achieve union. Fundamentally, then, love becomes the desire or the need to end or escape this feeling of the anxiety of separateness, or it becomes the desire for union. Now, in man's need to end separateness, he attempts at first to achieve this by trying to take things and make them part of himself, by taking possession of things and by escaping temporarily from the awareness of separateness by artificial means. Sexual possession, auto-trance states, for instance, drum dancing, alcoholic or drug-induced stupors, hallucinations are examples. Even though such experiences veil the experience of separateness only temporarily and only briefly. Now, as a man matures, he may satisfy this need to overcome separateness to achieve union by additional, more subtle, and even gentle ways. conformity, the desire to blend in with the group, whether it be the conservative group or the liberal group or the gray flannel establishment group or the hippie group or whatever you want to call it. This desire to be a part of the group and indistinguishable from it, from its other members, is a manifestation of this need for unity. Creative activity in an artist can be another manifestation. He unites himself with his materials, which can represent the world, and in the process of his creation, achieves a kind of sense of unity of mind with matter. But none of these three means of ending separateness, that is of trance, drugs, conformity, or even creativity, include necessarily an interpersonal union, a fusion, a merging with other human beings. And a sexual union is only physical and transitory. He suggests, therefore, that any real solution to the problem of separateness must be able to achieve something more than just a temporary solution, and that we have to resolve this vital question of interpersonal union if we are to say that we have done so. Therefore, love is not merely the need or the desire for union, but it is the need for a lasting interpersonal union with other humans. However, just as the relationship different people may have with another may differ, that is, a mother and a child, a husband and a wife, a friend and a friend, so can the form or the way of interpersonal union differ. Should we call all these things love, or only part of them? And you recall here again that we got into the same kind of a jam back 2,500 years ago by thinking of love and confusing it with the object love and then creating a profusion of things. Fromm himself analyzes and distinguishes the nature of many of these relationships and qualities and degrees of union achievable within these types of relations, and hence many types of love. Parental love for a child, which can be distinguished into the unconditional love of mother that accepts the child, or the more conditional love of the father, which seems to insist upon a certain conformity to an ideal, or love will be withdrawn. And there are a variety of relations that can exist between equals, such as friend and friend, or husband and wife. Or you can maintain that superior dependent type of relationship from childhood, even when you grow to be an adult. Neurotic love patterns are often a result. Friendship implies a mutual filling of needs for at one-ment. Erotic love superficially embodies a union on the physical level, but if it involves the mind and the will, it can also take place at additional different levels and reach the essence of a being and involve a union of a higher order. The same may be said about the level in any relationship other than that. If one communes with another being on the level of the soul, the union of friendship is a far more magnificent thing than even the warmest friendship of mind or common interest and the like. This is, I think, what is meant when they talk about the fellowship of the spirit, which many religions speak of. However, love has to include one's relationship to oneself. Self-love. And here, let's distinguish between selfishness and self-love. Psychologically speaking, the selfish person doesn't love himself. In fact, these two, selfishness and self-love, are opposite. The selfish person, in fact, may hate himself. His lack of fondness and satisfaction with himself leaves him frustrated and empty. He seeks possession of objects and the like in a vain attempt to compensate for this lack of care about himself. Most selfish people are largely incapable of loving others, but this is because they are not capable of first loving themselves. Now, selfishness is the desire to possess something for oneself alone. Possession is therefore a process whereby one attempts to separate off the object of desire in order to possess it, to make it one with oneself. In this sense, one makes that which one possesses separate also. Even the possession in union, if one makes it a part of oneself, cannot therefore solve the problem of separateness. Thus, possession, even in union, is separating the object of desire by making it one with me, and thus separate also. And this, I think, is at the root of our dissatisfaction as we break off and accumulate those possessions. This is what I mean by selfishness. Now, surely love, if its desire for union, is something other than this. Union can only be achieved in two ways that we might be able to define: by making the object of union one with me, or by making myself one with the object of union. And I suggest to you, is not this latter process what we call giving? Thus, love, conceived as a desire for union or non-separateness, can only be achieved by giving, not by taking or possessing. Symbiotic love has one member superior and one member dependent in a relationship, one active, one passive, as in the case of a mother and a newborn child. Mature love is a relationship in which all parties are active, neither superior nor dependent, retaining their independence and individuality in the union. Now, by independence in union, I understand a relationship of union that involves freedom. That is, each gives to the other. There is not a compulsion of one taking and the other being taken from. But the giving that is love in no way implies painful sacrifice. Giving is the highest expression of one's potency. The act of giving, in that act, one can experience his strength, his wealth, his power. Giving is thus almost like the cup overflowing. And this experience of heightened vitality makes one alive, fills one with joy. What one gives produces its like. Love creates love. Love is the power to produce love. Now, this ability to love, that is, to fulfill the desire or need for union by giving of oneself, depends upon the degree of maturity and character development of the individual. Narcissism, dependency, the wish to exploit others, to hoard, these have to be overcome. The necessary ingredients, then, are faith in one's own human powers and the courage to rely on these to obtain one's goals. In addition to the element of giving, the active character of love implies care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. Care and love is the active concern for the life and the growth of that which we love. Responsibility is the response to the needs of the one being loved. Respect is the ability to see the person as he really is. And knowledge in love is that knowledge that penetrates to the core, the essence of the other being, and allows him to be what he is. When all these elements are present in the act of giving, a mature union can result. Therefore, love is not merely the desire for union, the elimination of separateness, distinguished in type by the nature of the relationship of the union, but rather it's one's attitude of relatedness to the world. And it is this attitude which determines whether or not and the degree to which you will be able to achieve a union. And because love is thus a capacity that incorporates this attitude, it is independent of the object of love. Stated most tellingly, if one can truly love, one loves everything. Or, if you really love one person, you love all persons. If there is any one person you do not love, you have not yet really evolved your full capacity to love any other person. A truth of brotherly love is thereby revealed. If one is fully capable of love, one loves all persons equally. For the differences in these objects of love have nothing to do with the nature of love. So, love involves union. In real union, there is a blending, a realization of oneness. Out of this experience of love, of union, comes the knowledge of the union of all men, of human at-one-ment. In the human essence, where union takes place, the experience of unity can reveal the life that's common to all men. Therefore, love is the only way to knowledge or wisdom. What is the only way you can really know truth or the essence of something, just an object, your cat? One can examine it, you can study it, you can dissect it, you can analyze it. These things we all do all the time in everything we look at. What we know are our sense impressions of it interpreted in the mind. One can try to put oneself in its place, imagination. We can pretend that we are my cat, or a spaceman going to the moon, or a stone. But in all these things, there's still a great gap in our knowledge of these objects. The only way I suggest to you that you can fully know anything is to become that thing. Such is the nature of union, the nature of love which leads to knowledge. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, I think, suggest something very similar to this, not the same. So the problem of knowing man, of knowledge, is the problem of loving man. And this immediately leads us to the problem of loving or knowing God. We might say that if our need to love lies in the experience of separateness and the resulting need to overcome this anxiety of separateness by the experience of union, then the religious form of love, love of God, might find itself having the same root. Now, just as an understanding of the meaning of love between men requires an understanding of what we mean by men, you know, what is their nature, in order to understand what love or union between them could mean, just something other than, say, just physical union, so an understanding of the different possible conceptions of the nature of God are necessary to understand the nature of what loving God might mean. Now, if by God one means only a symbol by which man can express all that for which he strives, then to love God would mean to long for the full capacity to love, for the realization of that which the symbol God stands for within oneself. Or if, on the other hand, what you mean by God is a sort of anthropomorphic symbol, a loving father with a white beard who helps us and hinders us, then love for this kind of a God is limited to our ability to understand the same qualities that might exist in a parent-child relationship. The nature and limit of the union possible is limited by the nature of the relationship. If, however, in line with ancient occult wisdom, teachings, and some of what the modern scientist may come to a conclusion of today, if by God we mean an infinite being or an infinite principle, here we find the consequences of loving this God something quite different. By infinite anything, I understand something all-pervading, that is, something that is all that exists. As such, existing everywhere without a second, it would be a one, or what they call today in science a continuum. As it is one, there would be no way of distinguishing it, for manifestation always requires limitation, duality, a bounding of it by something by virtue of which you distinguish what's bound from what isn't bound. But it wouldn't be infinite if it were these. And so since it is one, it's indistinguishable as one. It appears as no thing. Hence, the religious teachers have said it's ineffable. As it is indistinguishable, it's indescribable, and hence one can predicate no attributes about it. This is why many of the great religions refuse to name God, for to give him a name would be to give him a limitation which would violate the very idea of infinity. Yet as the infinite, it must contain all that is manifest. That is, all that is manifest lives and moves and has its being in that one. So it is paradoxically true, therefore, in this sense, to say that it has an infinity of attributes. All that is that manifests may be attributed to it, but as it is one, it dissolves all these contraries, it reconciles all these opposites, it absorbs all the paradoxes. It is. It's the root, ultimate reality. Well, how in the world do you love such a God as this? Let's review our exploration. We started out here in this somewhat heavy trip. We saw that love could be conceived as being desire of something. Next, we examined the idea as the desire not for just anything, but for the good, and ultimately for the highest good. We then looked at the idea of love as the desire or the need for the elimination of the anxiety of separateness, the desire for union, and especially interpersonal union. And then we began to see love as something more than a desire for union, to see it as an attitude toward the world, as an activity or a capacity enabling effective realization of an interpersonal union. Let's now try to extend these ideas further. If the idea of love describes at one level the need for union, and at another level the capacity for achieving effective union, might it not also be that at a still higher level of experience, it would include the actual experience of union? Visualize, if you will, love as the realization, the experience of union, the experience of being one with another, at one moment. But how can this be so? How can I be you? How can you be me? How can we be everyone? How can we really be brothers? If by me and by you, you mean our physical bodies, it's obvious that I am not you, and you are not me, and that we're not one. But if you mean by you and me our minds, our attitudes, our opinions, emotions, such phrases as we commonly use, such as of one mind, of one opinion, these reveal a form of unity that might take place. Now, there do exist states of consciousness in which the apparent boundaries of separation are dissolved and intense feelings of intuition of oneness are realized with another. I'm not trying to be mystical. This is something you have done yourself. It possibly as a mother will feel this way momentarily with her child. Young lovers sometimes hold see the loved one, and feel this intense realization of unity. Fond companions, or man alone in the hush of twilight, may feel this with impersonal nature. Often in our own lives, we have these brief episodes where we seemed in perfect harmony with nature, our surroundings, or another person, and an intense intuition of this state fills our hearts and our beings with that feeling of oneness, and sometimes we call it love, and sometimes we call it peace. And yet the feeling passes, and though filled with the wonder of it, we say, how can this be? To understand this, we must try to understand the essence of the meaning of union. For there to be true union, there must be a complete unity. That is, the personal identifying of oneself as a separate entity from another participating in the union must cease. Stated differently, it's only by trying to be somebody that you cut yourself off from everybody else. The essential, the non-essential manifesting differences between us have to be broached. The boundaries limiting us must cease to limit. No, they have to cease to exist. Not only the idea, but the fact of separateness must cease. One must be the other. But how can this be? Surely one can only be what one is. And if one cannot be other than what one is, how can there be union? And if there is no union, what is love? To resolve this paradox, it seems to me we have to come back to our conception of God. We have seen how the conception of God as infinite involves necessarily the concept of God as one. And if one, then all that is manifest, has its root in this one, is at its heart, is fundamentally that one. Therefore, each one and every one of us and everything that is at the core in some way this one. This one reality. And it's in the realization of this, in the experience of this, alone that we can realize union. In fact, genuine, true, real union can only take place at this level. For this is the only level at which real unity exists. The only realm in which one can be another, that is, that other that he is essentially. Therefore, if love is the experience of union, and if the only true or complete union that can exist is that union of a being who is at his root, the one, with that one, that is, with that which he is essentially, then complete love exists only in the experience of union with the one. Love is the experience of union with the one. True love is and exists only in man's realization of union with the one, his own essential unity with that one. Now, we've called the one in most of the world's religions God. Therefore, love is the union with God. Or stated more simply, as we hear it all the time, God is love. The sense and meaning of the world's religious scriptures become clearer in this light. The great truths of the admonitions to love one another and to love God shine with a different meaning. The truth of the doctrine of brotherhood is demonstrated at the root we are one. God is love, complete and perfect love, which for man can exist only in complete and perfect union. Perfect union is possible only with God, the one, the part of which man is in essence. Therefore, complete or perfect love for man exists only in his own realization, his own inner experience of his own essential unity with God. Love must go. Perhaps this is why one of the great masters of the Theosophical Society, in teaching a young man about the qualifications for the path of holiness, calls the fourth qualification, love, the most important. And I'd like to recall for you a part of his instruction. Of all the qualifications, love is the most important, for if it is strong enough in a man, it forces him to acquire all the rest, and all the rest without it would never be sufficient. It is not so much desire as will, resolve, determination. To produce its result, this resolve must fill your whole nature so as to leave no room for any other feeling. It is indeed the will to be one with God, in order that because of your deep love for him, you may act with him and as he does. Because he is love, you, if you would become one with him, must be filled with perfect unselfishness and love also. Would that we all may achieve to this qualification for the path.